This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello and welcome to Westminster. I'm Susan Hume. Coming up in the podcast, a minister says it is completely unacceptable that some adult social care is substandard. But a Conservative says the party only has itself to blame for claims that it would bring in a dementia tax to pay for social care.
The only reason the Labour Party was able to mention dementia tax was because the Conservative Party had put something stupid in their manifesto.
Also tonight, concern that equality policy is under pressure because of the Tory deal with the Democratic Unionist Party.
The DUP once ran a campaign called Save Ulster from Sodomy. Isn't it time to save Ulster from bigotry?
And the International Trade Secretary attacks certain media organisations.
It does appear that some elements of our media would rather see Britain fail than see Brexit succeed.
But first, the news that almost a quarter of adult social care in England is not safe enough triggered a demand for urgent statements in Parliament. The Care Quality Commission, or CQC's, latest report said that while the majority of adult social care was of a high quality, too many people were receiving care that was not good enough. In one home, people were hauled out of bed to be washed and changed from as early as 5 a.m. Some were then put back to bed to make it easier for staff to care for them. The report cited other examples of elderly people being shouted at, humiliated, or living in dirty, smelly conditions. In the Commons, the Minister, Steve Brown, was heartened that the majority of care was good or outstanding, but the strains could not be ignored.
We've seen the numbers of over 65s increase by nearly 1.2 million, or around 14% over the last 5 years. And today's CQC report shows that in some areas, it is completely unacceptable that standards in some settings are below those rightly expected by care users and their families.
He pointed to the extra £2 billion over 3 years made available in the budget last spring, and that local authorities would be allowed to raise more for adult social care from council tax. But his Labour shadow, Barbara Keeley, who called for the statement, was concerned that councils who don't put a care package in place quickly enough when people are ready to leave hospital would not get the extra funds.
That means that some councils could lose funding that they have already planned to spend. Does the minister accept that threatening local councils with a loss of planned funding could actually lead to the worsening of the quality and safety issues highlighted today? With social care in crisis, this is not the time to be threatening joint working with local councils.
Steve Brown insisted there were no threats, but he added the allocation of the extra money to poorly performing councils could be reviewed in November. The Lib Dem Norman Lamb was a care minister in the coalition. He thought there was a straightforward answer to the lack of funding to care for an increasing elderly population.
These widespread failures of care are intolerable in a civilised society. And does he share my view that we will have to confront the need to increase taxes to ensure that we have an efficient and effective and compassionate system? And would he embrace a cross-party approach to come up with a long-term settlement?
Labour's Rachel Maskell wondered, after the inspections, then what?
Of the care homes requiring improvement, on re-inspection, 38% still require improvement and 5% have deteriorated. So what action is the minister taking beyond just inspection to improve standards?
The minister said 12 local areas with the worst problems would be reviewed to see how management and resources could be used better. The Conservative election manifesto policy on social care would see people's assets, over £100,000, used to pay for long-term care if they needed it, soon dubbed the dementia tax by critics. The manifesto didn't say there'd be any limit on the overall amount an individual would pay, though the Prime Minister later insisted there would be one. Many Conservatives still felt the policy had cost them votes, but one, Matthew Offord, felt it was right to face up to the issues.
With an increasing ageing population, does the Minister agree with me that it's deeply cynical to pretend there's some financial solution to this issue that doesn't involve very difficult decisions both within and across generations?
The Minister agreed.
There were many disappointing things for me about the recent general election, but I can say that one of the more disappointing things was that the debate around the future of adult social care was reduced to using the words dementia tax.
But another Conservative, Peter Bone, was not sympathetic.
I'd say gently to the Minister, the only reason the Labour Party was able to mention dementia tax was because the Conservative Party had put something stupid in their manifesto. And really, sir, this is far, far too important a matter for party politics. And would the Minister agree with me? We need the social care system is broken and we need a cross-party agreement of how to move forward.
The Minister agreed that the issue was too important for knockabout politics. He said the government would consult on its manifesto proposals, but those would include both a floor and a cap on the amount anyone would pay. You're listening to Today in Parliament with me, Susan Hume. Coming up, there are worse things an MP can do than going without a tie.
Such as wearing a gaudy tie or a garish waistcoat.
But first, the Equalities Minister has told MPs there will be no backsliding on rights for lesbian, gay and transgender people by this government. Some MPs have expressed concern that policies could come under pressure following the Conservatives' deal with the Northern Ireland Democratic Unionist Party. Alicia McCarthy reports.
After the election, Theresa May entered into a deal with the DUP to support her minority government. The agreement came at a price, with the Prime Minister agreeing an extra £1 billion in funding for Northern Ireland. The DUP opposes same-sex marriage, and Northern Ireland is the only part of the UK where it's not legal. Senior Conservatives, including the Tories' leader in Scotland, Ruth Davidson, have demanded assurances that won't affect policies for gay and transgender men and women, known as LGBT rights. At question time in the Commons, the Shadow Equalities Minister, Paula Sheriff, attacked the unionists' views.
DUP representatives have described homosexuality as repulsive, wrong, vile, immoral, offensive and obnoxious. Does the Minister agree that it is these hateful remarks themselves that are repulsive, wrong, vile, immoral, offensive and obnoxious?
Such views, she insisted, had no place in politics, let alone in government.
The DUP once ran a campaign called Save Ulster from Sodomy. Isn't it time to save Ulster from bigotry?
She was putting her question to the Equalities Minister, Justine Greening, who said those were not her views or she thought those of other MPs. The way forward was to have a measured debate.
Where we can, we find some consensus and that we steadily will win the battle in that fashion.
A Labour MP, Anna McMorrin, wanted the Minister to go further.
Will the Minister work to overturn the ongoing ban on equal marriage in Northern Ireland, or does she believe that £1 billion is a fair price to pay for selling off these fundamental values?
Justine Greening said she was proud to have been part of the government that introduced equal marriage, but there was still progress to be made. A Conservative, Nick Herbert, wanted a cast-iron guarantee.
Will my right honourable friend assure me that she will remain fully committed and the government will remain fully committed to protecting LGBT rights both at home and abroad where there is work still to do?
The Minister said she could absolutely give those assurances.
There will be no backsliding on LGBT rights from this government. We aim to continue the progress that's been made working across this House and cross-party. We will seek to do that within the UK, but also around the world. And I will be part of the London Pride celebrations myself this weekend. And I'm very proud that after this election, we actually now have more openly LGBT MPs in this House than I think in any other parliament in the world.
But the SNP's Angela Crawley wasn't entirely convinced.
Despite a number of promises during the election campaign on the need to strengthen and protect equality legislation, there was no commitment in this year's Queen's speech. People across this country have deep concerns that the Tory backroom deal with the DUP could undermine or halt equality here in the UK. What assurances will the Minister provide that progress on equality will not be sidelined for political expediency?
Justine Greening said she'd given those assurances and would be happy to do so again, but to continue to suggest there could be backsliding.
I don't think is a very helpful approach to having a cross-party consensus to move forward on these issues.
The DUP's Jim Shannon turned to his party's record on equality.
I have spoken with my party leader, who is a woman, my close constituency colleague in MLA, who just happens to be a woman, and my most senior member of staff, who is my close advisor and, shockingly, is also a woman, about equality and their rights in our party. They seem to be satisfied. And subsequently, I would ask the Minister this question. I wonder what discussions have been held with Labour's sister party, the SDLP, who hold many of the same moral issue stances that we hold, which is what I believe this question is really seeking to highlight.
The Minister said there was a debate to be had across parties in Westminster and in Northern Ireland, but what was needed was a measured approach and an informed discussion.
Alicia McCarthy reporting. Now, the International Trade Secretary, Liam Fox, has accused the BBC and other media organisations of preferring to see Britain fail than see Brexit succeed. He was responding to the concerns of a Conservative, Nigel Evans.
I think the potential for trade with Commonwealth countries is very exciting, growing economies, strong economies. But every time I open a newspaper or listen to the radio or TV, the story is done very negatively. It's going to be impossible for us to do these trade deals. Does he feel that it's both wrong and undermines the work that he's doing?
Yeah. Liam Fox went on the attack.
It does appear that some elements of our media would rather see Britain fail than see Brexit succeed. I cannot recall a single time in recent times when I have seen good economic news that the BBC didn't describe as despite Brexit.
Labour's Barry Shearman criticised that.
This frontbench team must know that a silly attack on the BBC cannot be used as an excuse for policy.
Barry Shearman said Liam Fox had refused to meet the all-party parliamentary manufacturing group, which is made up of parliamentarians and industry organisations. Mr Shearman said manufacturing representatives
have no confidence in the Secretary of State. He's living in cloud cuckoo land. They think he's not competent and they want his resignation.
The International Trade Minister, Mark Garnier, replied that he would take note of those comments. Well, there was a rather negative view of Brexit on display along the corridor when the former Conservative Party leader and Foreign Secretary Lord Hague told a committee of peers that Brexit would undoubtedly damage the UK's international influence. Lord Hague was appearing alongside a former NATO Secretary General and a former EU foreign policy chief who both echoed his warning. Simon Jones was watching.
It was a straight question. What impact would the UK's departure from the European Union have on Britain's foreign policy and influence internationally? And it got a straight answer.
Brexit will be damaging to our ability to work with other EU countries, obviously on foreign affairs, and to influence their outlook overall.
The former Conservative Party leader and later Foreign Secretary, William, now Lord Hague, speaking to a committee of peers which is looking at the potential impact on the UK of Brexit. Lord Hague said the UK's close ties with the European Union amplifies the UK's weight in the world.
We're at a time of a danger of fragmentation of the Western world. We can see that for many reasons and in many ways, as the forthcoming summit in Germany is demonstrating. And so UK participation in influencing the foreign affairs of the other EU nations is a crucial aspect of averting such a fragmentation.
His concerns were echoed by Lady Ashton, a former Labour leader of the Lords who went on to become the EU's first foreign policy chief.
The big and most fundamental issue is that in the process of working up the way in which policy is developed and determining what Europe's policy would be, we won't be in the room to either influence it in one way or another. And that will be a loss to the European Union and potentially a loss to our capacity to develop policy.
Lord Robertson was a Labour Defence Secretary before becoming NATO Secretary General.
Brexit changes the political relationship with the EU27. It doesn't change the geography. It doesn't change the nature of the common threats that we face. And in many ways, it does not affect the cooperation that is essential on handling the future security threats as well.
But the UK, he believed, would lose traction in shaping EU defence and foreign policy, just at a time when relations between the United States and NATO appeared to be changing. Europe would have to do more militarily, and the UK needed to be involved.
European defence actually is Britain and France. That's what it is. These are the only two countries with the capability, with the headquarters, and the ability to do things. So how we move forward on that is going to be complex and difficult.
Lord Haig told the committee that while he had opposed Brexit, he accepted that the UK would be leaving the EU. But he predicted the EU would continue to want Britain's participation and support, pointing out that Britain had the biggest military and development budgets of any nation in the EU.
There are many things that can't effectively be done by Europe without some degree of participation and support from the United Kingdom. And therefore, the degree to which it is damaging depends on what we put in place to enable the maximum cooperation. And I think that will require a lot of political commitment by ministers, but also a specific a framework designed for this purpose.
Maintaining the closest possible ties, he said, was important.
An enhanced framework participation agreement between the UK and the EU on foreign affairs, something of that kind would mitigate the damage that will undoubtedly be caused.
But Lord Robertson questioned whether such an arrangement would be possible.
The worry for me would be is that a whole series of issues concerned with foreign policy and security are going to be debated by people in the room who are unlikely to want to give permanent and guaranteed status to a country like the United Kingdom, because that, in a way, would establish a precedent that they might not be willing to give.
Labour's Lady Simons, a former Foreign Office minister, turned to the wider stage.
Are you saying that our influence would be diminished not only in Europe, but our influence would be diminished when we go and talk to the United States if we are not a member of the Union, of the European Union, or our influence at the UN will be diminished?
Lord Haig said that was more complex, but on balance, his answer was yes.
I think it necessarily follows that if you're less influential in crafting the overall approach of the EU, you end up with less influence in the rest of the world. And I think there will be less solidarity with Britain in votes at the United Nations.
Britain, he said, would have to make an even greater effort to compensate for the loss of influence the country faced.
Simon Jones reporting. Now, a wholly positive view of Brexit was given by Liam Fox when the International Trade Secretary appeared for a second time in the Commons during a general debate on exiting the EU and global trade. Liam Fox said the UK would continue to offer its customers around the world high standards and high quality.
From our food and drink industry, to our technological expertise, to our financial services, people across the world buy British because they see the Union flag as a kite mark of quality. And the key to our long-term prosperity lies not in abandoning our values and standards, but in reinforcing them.
The Conservative Rishi Sunak, who's now the MP for William Hague's old seat in Yorkshire, said Liam Fox was making a powerful and optimistic speech.
Leaving the customs union will give us the ability to reduce import tariffs on many goods we do not produce here at home, which will reduce costs for ordinary working families and benefit many developing countries, helping them trade into prosperity.
The Shadow International Trade Secretary, Barry Gardner, said Liam Fox should publish a government paper on trade policy outlining the UK's future objectives. He said it might restore business confidence if there was a clear plan.
If not, it will reinforce the sense that the government is blundering into this process without a clear end game and lacking a strategic understanding of the issues at stake for the UK economy and for jobs in this country.
And that debate ended without a vote. Now, the SNP has described this session of Parliament as a zombie apocalypse because of the lack of major government business. Ministers have had to abandon many of the more controversial ideas in the Conservative election manifesto after failing to win a big enough majority to get them passed into law. The SNP spokesman, Pete Wishart, wondered how much longer the government could pad out the time with uncontroversial bills.
Mr. Speaker, there was no votes this week. There's not going to be any votes next week. There's probably not going to be any votes the week before that. There'll be no votes before we get into the summer recess. This is quickly becoming the zombie apocalypse parliament where the governing undead wander the streets of Whitehall looking for brains, only to discover they've all left the country because of Brexit, like everybody else.
The Commons leader, Andrea Leadsom, said the government was taking significant steps to improve the situation of people right across the UK.
Now, he says that there have been no votes, and I think that that is a testament to the agreement across the House that what we are doing is indeed the right thing.
The Leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom. The Work and Pensions Secretary has been called to the Commons to explain the government's decision to close and merge job centres across the UK, with the loss of up to 750 jobs. Six job centres are set to close in Glasgow alone. But ministers argue that with much more activity taking place online, the physical offices are being used less. Mandy Baker reports.
The Work and Pensions Secretary, David Gawke, said the government's plans regarding job centres would save more than £140 million a year. 8 out of 10 claims for Job Seekers Allowance and almost all Universal Credit applications were made online, so it made sense to review the way buildings were used. But the SNP's Chris Stevens wasn't impressed with the way in which the news had been announced.
Compassionate conservatism lasted fully 2 days.
Yep.
There should have been an oral statement and a vote in this House on this issue. Does the Secretary of State accept that there's a direct link with the index of multiple deprivation and those job centres earmarked for closure?
David Gawke insisted Glasgow would still be well served.
It will be the case, after these reforms have been completed, where there will be a reduction in the number of job centres in Glasgow, that Glasgow will still have more job centres per head of population than any other city in the United Kingdom.
Labour's Tracy Brabin had conducted a survey outside her local job centre in West Yorkshire.
The majority of users actually walk there often every day to use the computers to look for jobs. With Batley's closing, they're going to have to walk to Dewsbury, a journey of 20 minutes if you're able-bodied. So can the Secretary of State confirm whether new sanctioning guidance will be provided for those who are late or miss appointments?
The SNP's Deirdre Brock was also concerned about penalties for people arriving late.
Evidence from the PCS Union to the Scottish Affairs Committee suggested job centre closures were likely to lead to increased numbers of people being late for appointments and therefore being sanctioned. And the Director of Poverty Alliance argued that government should therefore reconsider sanctions for lateness. Will the Minister now confirm he is actually committed to doing so?
David Gawke didn't think travel was necessarily an excuse for lateness.
Travelling to a job centre, just in the way that people travel to work, is the way life operates for most people. But if there are particular circumstances that result in somebody being late for an assessment or for a meeting, then that's something that can be taken into account.
But it wasn't just about getting to the job centre on time. A Labour MP, Maria Eagle, believed vulnerable people would be most affected by the changes.
Requiring some sick and disabled people to travel further to attend compulsory interviews is likely to lead to more cost, hardship and worry for the most vulnerable of our constituents who are looking for jobs. So what will he do to ensure that his plans do not leave these vulnerable people hit the hardest?
David Gawke said the changes would chiefly affect job seekers rather than disability claimants. Labour's Paul Blomfield said a job centre in his Sheffield constituency earmarked for closure was rooted in the community.
Its staff therefore understand local people and they can do the job better supporting them because of that. The Secretary of State talks about a much improved service. Does he not recognise that centralising the service, breaking that link with the local community, will damage the work that the job centre can do, and will he think again?
But a Conservative, Christopher Chope, the MP for Christchurch, didn't think the cuts were the end of the world.
When the Labour government closed down the Christchurch job centre, the sky did not fall in. But can I also ask my right honourable friend whether it wouldn't be sensible now with fewer job centres to ensure that they're open at weekends?
David Gawke said that was something he was keeping under review.
Mandy Baker reporting. There have been more nerve-wracking moments in the Commons for new MPs as they delivered their first or maiden speeches. A Conservative, Neil O'Brien, who was elected in Harborough, pressed the case for more funding for education.
So I grew up in Huddersfield, I went to a comprehensive, I got to go to Oxford and I've ended up in this house. And I want young people in my constituency to have the same chances that I've had. It simply cannot be right that school pupils in Harborough, Oadby and Wigston get so much less funding than children in identical circumstances in other areas.
Another Conservative, Julia Dockrell, who's the new MP for Hornchurch and Upminster, said the UK must be pragmatic in preparing for life outside the EU.
But too often, debate on how we do this is infected by a corrosive pessimism that betrays a lack of confidence in our nation and what we can offer the world. Now is a time for resilience, resourcefulness and self-belief. Not a crowing self-regard, but nevertheless an appreciation that our people and what we have created together has value.
Labour's Karen Lee is the MP for Lincoln. She said the city boasted two universities which achieved the highest ratings in national assessments.
Yet many of the students who live in our city struggle with a mountain of debt because of paying the huge cost of tuition fees. And they live in privately rented homes which are often poorly maintained, paying high rents which increase the amount of debt they accumulate. How can that be fair?
Alistair Jack, elected in Dumfries and Galloway for the Conservatives, was brimming with pride.
I'm proud to have been elected to represent Dumfries and Galloway, proud to be one of a baker's dozen of Scottish Conservatives. Proud to be one of a baker's dozen of Scottish Conservatives returned to Westminster. I'm proud that we have turned the tables and imposed a Conservative government on the English.
Jamie Stone is the new Lib Dem MP for Caithness, Sutherland and Easter Ross. He seemed determined to test the Hansard reporters with some Gaelic.
We have a saying. It is this. Tocha can mór chiclachan beca. The mighty cairn is built of little stones. I do hope, Madam Deputy Speaker, that this particular stone myself may play a suitable part in the mighty cairn that is democracy in this special place.
The new MP for Midlothian is Labour's Danielle Rowley, who said she was proud to be the first woman to represent the constituency. And she echoed a Labour election slogan.
I'm proud to have been elected here to represent the people of Midlothian on a platform of hope and with the message that I'm joining my friends on these benches to fight for the many, not the few. Yeah.
Danielle Rowley there. Finally, in the midst of all the debate about foreign affairs, jobs and social care, MPs did find a moment to fret about the appropriate way for men MPs to dress. The Lib Dem Tom Brake was last week given the nod from the Speaker to remain tieless in the chamber. But this week, a minister, John Hayes, the MP for South Holland and the Deepings, insisted on tradition and said he would not take interventions from any MP who wasn't wearing one. Tom Brake took it up with the Speaker.
Do you think that there is a risk of a slippery slope which might lead that member to refuse to take interventions from members who are sartorially challenged in other ways, such as wearing a gaudy tie or a garish waistcoat?
The Speaker, a moderniser, suggested John Hayes had been joking.
However, insofar as I could be said to have received an application from the Right Honourable Gentleman by virtue of his pronouncement for the role of style policeman.
And?
I have filed the application from the Right Honourable Member for South Holland and the Deepings for that post in the appropriate place.
The Speaker, Ella Mould. Finally, the main news again. The government has said it is completely unacceptable that some adult social care in England is substandard. I'm Susan Hume. The editor was Rachel Byrne. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thank you for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.